Why, hello there, you. Before you get on and listen to this latest episode, I want to ask you a question. Do you have enough Myrtleade in your life? If the answer is no, did you know that you can get exclusive access to 2 whole previous seasons, dozens of exclusive episodes, and a catalogue of minisodes? All you have to do is head on over to patreon.com/Myrtleade, spelt Myrtleade, and join our Patreon family. For as little as $5 a month, you get more Myrtleade than your strange mind can handle. The more you pledge, the more you get. Seriously, guys, that is like a single cup of coffee per month, and you help support me as a creator, and you help keep this podcast an ad-free zone. Because, you know, there has to be one space in our lives that's ad-free. Okay. On with today's offering. Welcome back, family, friends, listeners, fans, whatever you call yourself. You're listening to episode 19 of Myrtleade, the Australian true crime podcast based in Adelaide, city of churches and sinners. In the interest of full disclosure, I need to tell you, friend, that I am not a journalist or an investigator. I'm just the daughter of a cop with a morbid fascination for crime happening in my city. This podcast contains graphic depictions of violence, salty language, and poor grammar. If any of these things offend you, feel free to fuck off right now. Information for today's episode came from listverse.com, Trove Digital, and the State Library Archives, and news.com.au. Last week's story was like a real bummer, and it really bummed me out. So I decided this week, reach back in time to somewhere less personal and less, you know, I was alive and heard about it and freaked out about it for many years, like I did with Louise Bell's case. I want to thank you all for being kind online to each other. It's been a much better week on the Facebook page with less like dogging of people and harassment. So yay for you. Look how much you chilled the fuck out. The story is also a personal one. It's an old one, and it began for me on a weekend trip with my son. We were driving from one tourist destination to the other in the States North, and we stopped at this little bizarre place. There was just this road marker saying historical site and pointing down a small road. At the end was a tiny graveyard with a handful of grave markers. It's known as Dawson Graveyard. 2 of the markers had matching white marble headstones with no dates, and they were missing 5 names. The 2 graves shared the same last name. They were separated by white, rusted, ornate cast iron. It seems that they were separate family plots. I was with a girlfriend and her kids, and the others quickly walked away and explored the other graves and a nearby derelict house and dry creek bed. My son and I took a picture of the graves. I found them really solemn and a little mysterious. one of these people who's totally into graveyards. My then eight-year-old son looked up at me and said, "Mum, why doesn't it have their names or the date on it?" This is the story of what I've discovered about those two family graves. And it starts on the 12th of October in 1896 with 17-year-old George Albert Thayer. He came home to the family farm in Pine Valley. He'd been away from home with his brother for the weekend. Pine Valley is about 230 kilometres from Adelaide, and in that time it was a really remote farming area. The rural, mainly sheep farming area where George and his seven siblings had spent their whole lives on this farm. Returning to it and riding up the driveway as he had so many times before, he had no clue what was waiting for him at the end of the driveway. George's father, Joseph, he himself was the son of a really successful grazier who had emigrated from England. His brother was also quite successful in the agricultural field. Joseph was not doing as well as the rest of his family. The property is on the edge of what I would call viable farming land. This perimeter of land that's very close to really fertile lush land, but it's prone to drought and flooding. It's one of those places where people are made or bankrupted in one generation. The previous few seasons had been hard on the Thayer farm, one where drought had seriously affected the bottom line. Many of the farm's sheep had died from starvation, and Joseph Thayer, the father of the family, had been forced to put down a great number of his livestock to prevent them from dying of starvation. On this Monday afternoon, while George was riding his horse up to his family farm, a place where he knew every turn in the road, every fence post, he saw something hanging from a frame in the stockyard, 100 metres from his lifelong home. Something that he knew didn't belong in the landscape. He walked his horse to the stockyard to investigate. And then poor 17-year-old boy found the body of his 44-year-old father, Joseph, hanging from a makeshift gallows. I can't even imagine that moment, can you? Having a nice weekend away with your brother and then come home to find that your father had suicided while you were away. George immediately ran into the house to get help for his father, not noticing that the farmhouse door had been left wide open. He ran first into his parents' bedroom, only to find more horror. There he discovered his mother, 36-year-old Elizabeth, his sister, 12-year-old Florence, and his 4-month-old baby brother lay dead in the bed. All three had their skulls smashed in with a hammer while they were sleeping together in the bed. Elizabeth had a white shawl placed over her head, stained through with blood and brains. George ran from the house and grabbed his horse. He raced to the next property and retrieved his uncle. Together, the young man and his uncle went through the house room by room and discovered the bodies of his other siblings: Edward, aged 9, Alexander, aged 7, and Charles, aged 6, all with their heads badly beaten and their throats cut from ear to ear. The family were all heavily disfigured and unrecognizable. The scene was gruesome. Some of the family had their heads struck with blunt force so savagely that the entire tops of their skull was removed in the attack. When the 1890s police arrived on site, they worked through the crime scene for 2 days. Conclusions from that examination revealed that Joseph had committed familicide, murdering his family and then committing suicide. The entire family was quite obviously asleep in beds on Sunday night when Joseph flipped his fucking lid and murdered his family with a hammer and a straight razor. I really feel like straight razors have a lot to fucking answer for. As the family had remained in the bed for 3 days, in heat that was said to be between 30 and 40 degrees centigrade. For Americans, that's Aussie for hot, like really fucking hot. One newspaper reported that the undertaker had to use, quote, the strongest of disinfectants to lessen the stench of death and decay. This takes me back to the gravesite. So on the 14th of October, 1896, Elizabeth Thayer, her 12-year-old daughter, were placed together in one coffin. With a bouquet of wildflowers placed in the young girl's hands, they were slowly lowered into the ground on a farm owned by Joseph's father. Next, Edward 9 and Alexander 7 were also put together in a single coffin and lowered into the ground next to their big sister and their mother. Lastly, little Charlie 6 and 4-month-old baby Roy were again placed in a single coffin together, lowered into the ground with their siblings and the mother. Elizabeth and her children have a single sad grave marker. It just reads simply, in sad remembrance of C. E. Thayer and her 5 little ones. Think about that last line. Her 5 little ones. No date, no names for the children, and certainly no mention of their father and killer. Joseph's life seems to have been pretty normal up until the last 5 or 6 months before the murders. He had been a well-respected and relatively successful grazier from a large family. In the months before his murder spree and eventual suicide, Joseph was under huge financial pressures. Things had gotten so bad he'd been killing the livestock because drought means no food or water, and he had been euthanizing the stock. Basically, he'd become a big fat failure. He was from a family of wealthy successes and he was losing grip. He complained to family and friends that he had pains in his head and he seems to have been experiencing explosive bouts of anger and no doubt domestic violence. To top it all off, the couple had had another baby, one more mouth to feed with the arrival of the then 4-month-old baby Roy. Anyone who has children knows the stress it puts on you. They had 7 children to care for. Joseph is buried in a little plot surrounded by a fence some distance away from his wife and children. There is one white marble headstone that matches the family's. It just says, "My beloved son, Joseph Thayer." When searching the family names, I also found another effect of what we see when something like this happens. This is a quote from the Evening Journal, October 1896, page 2. Quote, "A melancholy interest attaches to the death of Mr. James Thayer, which took place in Parkside Lunatic Asylum last week. He was the father of Mr. Joseph Thayer, who recently murdered his wife and 5 children and then committed suicide. Mr. James Thayer, who had attained the age of 69 years, was removed to the asylum shortly after the terrible occurrence. He had once been a very profitable sheep station owner at Eucalta near Lancelot, but the advance of agricultural settlement and losses caused by successive dry seasons brought financial disaster. So in a nutshell, Joseph's father was hospitalized in a mental institution the same month as the murders committed by his son. The deaths of his daughter-in-law and 5 grandchildren. He subsequently died within days. There is no mention of the cause of his death, but one can only guess. What was left of this family seems to have rebuilt and restored itself. The 2 remaining sons of Elizabeth and Joseph appear to have looked after their grandmother, married, and had families of their own. And so it goes that the people who loved this family died, and then their children died, and then their grandchildren died. And this familicide has just been lost to history. And all that is left is two stark white marble headstones surrounded by beautiful old fences, sitting rusting away in threadbare weeds and red dust in the middle of a paddock in the middle of nowhere. The brutality and terror felt by those tiny children on the night their dad stole their lives must have been indescribable. The entire settlement must have been in total disbelief for some time. The family would have been scarred beyond repair. I want to shout out a thank you to all the hard work of the people at Trove, people who are digitizing those really old newspapers and doing the work of preserving our history, good and bad. Thank you to everyone for the kind words while I was ill. And I want to let you know, merch is being printed as I speak. So soon you will be able to support the podcast and own your very own Myrtleade tea, even as early as next week. I'm having organic, ethical clothing printed locally, so I am getting my shit together, albeit slowly. Thank you all for listening. If you want to join in the after show conversation at Myrtleade_podcast on Instagram or Myrtleade the podcast on Facebook. If you have any show suggestions, email me at myrtleade@gmail.com. As always, sleep with one eye open and call the cops on all your dodgy neighbours. Sleep tight. Hello again, it's me, Anne. Can I ask you a favour? If you liked this episode of Myrtleade or any previous episodes, please take a moment to rate and review. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts or alternately, head on over to Facebook and rate the show at the Myrtleade the Podcast page. Every rate and review helps other strange ones find us and join the family. Oh yeah, and I totally mean that in a creepy Manson family or the Aussie cult, the family kind of way. Thanks for listening.